Where in the world did he get a lid to a trash can?
Well, he brought his plunder. He brought it.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the largest crowd in the United States ever to see a world championship wrestling event.
Damn, Conan's going on.
You might see it wrestling here, and that's what it's called, world championship wrestling.
Now, this could be the blivet off the top right here.
This could be off the top.
It's going to be more than a blivet off the top.
Now, that is the man who is using his head.
Oh, using his Harley.
He beat him with a hog.
That's a rubber shark.
A man just beat him with a rubber shark.
He's beating a man with a rubber shark.
Double underhook leading to the powerbomb called the Tiger Driver in Japan, and he gets just a two count.
Is that like a cult?
No, that's no. That's good, Iron Mike.
That's one for the highlight reel right there. And another one.
Tell you what, man.
Let's get this show on the road.
Grab your plunder and open the pay window. It's time for Survey Says.
Now let's hook him up and kick it off.
The longest running monthly episodic WCW centric podcast on Place to Be Nation Wrestling, here for another fun filled edition. I feel like we probably could have made that claim without so many qualifiers, and probably even after our first episode, but no matter. Hi, everybody, and welcome to WCW Survey Says. Tonight, we come to you live from the Club La Vila in Panama City Beach, Florida. Now, with me as always, my tag team partner, Andy Savage Helene. Andy, how are you? Actually, now that I think about it, what are you wearing tonight?
Well, shit, I thought we were going to be in Sturgis, so I wore some chaps today.
Ah, shit. I see they're assless chaps as well. You know, I guess all chaps are technically assless, but you sort of forgot to do something underneath those chaps. But that's okay. Rolling right along here, I'd say you still look less out of place than Rowdy Roddy Piper in 1997 at this very same venue. Now, I, however, am coated head to toe in zinc oxide. That's to disguise how incredibly pale I am, of course. We are jamming out some yacht rock. We're partying it up because it is spring break. Now, if these things seem somewhat at odds, I believe all will be made clear as I bring in our special guest right now. If you listen to any of the Place to Be family of podcasts with any regularity, you have no doubt become accustomed to hearing this voice at least a couple of times a week. That's whether he's a correspondent on Clotheslines and Headlines, co-host of the sensational new Dadcast, Taking the Nation by Storm, or the OG gold standard Place to Be Nation Vintage Vault. He's of many podcasts, many talents, many names. He's the Grand Poobah, the godfather of Place to Be Nation, Svengali Supreme. We've got JT Rosero in the booth here this evening. JT, how you doing?
My 9021 bros, how are you?
Doing most excellent. Now, you know, I really enjoyed your first episode of the Dadcast. Speaking of 90210, I had no idea how layered and rich the inner lives of the characters on that show really were.
90210 or Paw Patrol?
Well, Paw Patrol.
Okay. Yeah, no, it was the comparisons just kind of flowed for me. You know, I look at a lot of things in the realm of 90210, so watching that endlessly is actually making those comparisons on a random Facebook post is what led to the creation of that podcast. And there's actually a new one coming in the next week or so. So I'll save the topic for a surprise, but it should be a hoot.
Yeah, looking forward to it. You definitely put a lot of thought into that and gave me a lot to think about. So makes me feel like I may be missing out on something there. But that is a topic for another day. Now, while we revel in these spring break festivities here, I'm really reminded of all the special spring breakout editions of WCW Monday Nitro from years past. So what I thought we'd do with our survey here tonight, let's take a look not only at those shows, but you know, on all the various kind of unique, exciting, out-of-the-box events that WCW experimented with over the years. We have detailed previously how WCW was always pretty big on their high concepts, but we want to turn particular focus to their more, let's say, visually ambitious outings. So whether that's an unusual venue, a cool set design, or just all-around effort to present themselves differently, we're zooming in, I guess you could say, on the optics. So with that said, Justin, we were honestly just kind of looking for an excuse to have you on our show at some point, and very glad to have you here tonight. But given the timing, we were also planning on doing a dedicated episode on the Spring Breakout Nitros. And Andy and I, in talking about it, we thought you'd be the perfect guest for that, just based on what we think we know about your interests and sensibilities. And, you know, that led to a broader conversation about all these theme shows that WCW put together, and it just sort of coalesced nicely. So having you as our guest tonight, we do want to talk a little bit about your history and just your relationship with WCW in general. I have known you long enough that I think I have a decent sense of what you're drawn to in pro wrestling and, you know, how you're a fan from a pretty early age. But I'm not sure where you stand with respect to WCW, to be quite honest. Now, were you watching in the early 90s sort of concurrently with the WWF? Were you, you know, flipping channels during the Monday Night Wars? How does WCW fit into your fandom?
Yeah, so I feel like it first came to my consciousness sometime in, like, 1991. Because I remember having, like, the trading cards from that time. And I have some of the, was it Galoob figures or whatever? Like, oh, the rubber ones. So, like, I feel like it was in my consciousness. I knew it existed at some point in 91. Because, like, even when Ric Flair came to the WWF, like, I knew who he was. Like, so, I don't know if it was just through magazines or, you know, maybe my dad was watching it. Like, I'm not sure exactly. I'm very hazy. The first thing I really remember getting into was, like, the tail end of the Dangerous Alliance. Like, I vividly remember my cousin was able to get a copy of the Dangerous Alliance Sting Squadron War Games match and watching that. And, like, really, really liking it and almost even claiming, like, I was going to start watching WCW more than WWF. And then I was like, well, wait, I don't have to make a decision. I'm 11. I have a lot of free time. I can do what I want. So
remarkable self-awareness.
Right, it's crazy. Like, wait a minute, I don't have to choose. I have no other responsibility. No, but it was, so I want to say it was like, I would say 92 is when I really started to pay attention to WCW. Like, I remember all the Sting and Jake Roberts stuff, like reading about the coal miner's glove. And I have a couple of magazines from 92. So I'm guessing I was watching probably semi-regularly. I would say 93 is when I really start to remember, like, watching Saturday Night every week, watching the clashes. Like, I remember a lot of stuff from 93, seeing it live, like the Kongs. I remember Flair's return with the Flair for the Gold. Like, I remember all of that stuff pretty vividly. So, yeah, I would say by 93, I was pretty avid WCW co-watcher along with WWF. But at the time, I would say WWF was always my, like, home promotion, of course. So if, like, WCW stole a guy, like, I was mad about it. So I don't say I hate watching WCW, but it was, like, I was always angry. Like, when they, whatever, when Hogan went there and then when Savage went there, and even like, Earthquake and Piper. And
it started to get ridiculous.
Right. The more people went, I felt like they were raiding my home promotion. And then I really hated Eric Bischoff, and he would take shots at WWF on Nitro. Like, I couldn't stand him. Yeah. So, yeah, it was weird. It was this weird love-hate relationship. I watched it right through the end after that, all the way to 2001. But for whatever reason, I was always – it was just always, like, the heel to me, I guess, in my life.
Well, that's kind of cool then. I like I said, I didn't really know where you stood. And it sounds like you certainly were not a Fairweather fan. You were in there really from the get-go, not, you know, back in the NWA days, of course, but you know, who was of our generation. We're all kind of around the same age, it seems like. So, you know, that sort of late 80s, early 90s period when we all started watching wrestling, it's kind of cool to hear WCW was on your radar even back then.
And it shows the importance of, like, TBS. Mm-hmm. That I was able to watch Saturday Night and Main Event and Pro, you know, like all, I mean, it was a stretch where I'd watch, like I said, I mean, whatever, the weekends were, you know, whatever, time killers. So it was, I'd get up at eight or nine or whatever it was on Sunday and watch Pro. I definitely remember watching Main Event. So, I mean, it was cool that we had access to that, that it wasn't a regional syndicated thing, that I was able to watch that show every week.
Yeah, that's a good point. They had, you know, not only the primetime slot with, WCW Saturday Night, which, well, it's a weekend show. It wasn't quite prime time, but Turner time, and, you know, early enough that it's before Braves games, before people really go out. So
6:05.
Exactly. You got a lot of eyes on the product.
I legit thought that Georgia was 5 minutes ahead, like time-wise. Like, you know, the time zones. Like, I thought they were, like, in between time zones, and I didn't understand the whole 6:05 thing, the five, you know, the whole schedule.
Like, you thought that was why they did it?
The whole schedule. I just, well, they must be 5 minutes behind or whatever, you know, however you, I guess behind, yeah, so we were 5 minutes ahead of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I watched Saved by the Bell religiously, too, on TBS, and, yeah, for whatever reason, I guess I just assumed that, or either I just convinced myself out of kayfabe that they were 5 minutes, 5 minutes behind everyone else for some reason.
That's hilarious. I bet you're not the only person, like the only kid growing up who thought that. I guess I never put much thought into it other than, okay, I know this is how I'm watching a TBS show, but
it was
that's
weird.
Pretty funny.
And in some ways it was cool because it lingered, you know, it was shrewd because while the, you know, the way TV was set up with like syndicated shows was they'd always go to commercial at the end. So the last like 5 minutes of the show would always be like pure commercial pretty much. So They were always still on programming while every other network was in that last 5 to 7 minute commercial run, before they do like the quick go home little segment. So that was neat. And of course my dad was a big like Andy Griffith fan too. So I watched a ton of that, Sanford and Son and all the other shows they had on TBS.
Yeah. My dad too. And I understand they kind of got some, I guess, almost preferential treatment in things like TV Guide, which were important back then because of the Turner time. You know, you couldn't just list it out. I mean, I guess you could in the grid with all the other stuff. But it drew special attention to TBS as, well, the superstation when they had to set it aside and put their programming out separately, sort of broken out from the pack. It made it seem like a bigger deal, even though it was just for the sake of, hey, this is technically on at a different time than everything else. So yeah, it was kind of shrewd. Seems like a very Ted Turner-esque thing to do too.
And it's funny because it kind of sets up our discussion tonight about how out of the box, right?
I was about to say that dovetails rather neatly into our topic tonight. We've sort of talked over the years about how WCW just tended to do things differently. They had a different way of promoting themselves once they really hit that national spotlight and were being looked at and perceived as a national promotion, or at least wanting to be perceived more as a national promotion when they really hit it big with Turner. You know, we saw that reflected in some of the early pay-per-views. They did a lot of, as we mentioned, high concepts, high concept shows, high concept matches. You know, you got the Chamber of Horrors match, right? You've got the Bunkhouse Stampede. You had the Lethal Lottery. And we could be here all day if we're talking about crazy, unique, unusual matches that they did. But again, I want to focus more on just that visual aesthetic and just how they presented their wrestling product, because it does definitely stand out in comparison to what the WWF was doing at the same time, and certainly what they're doing today, where we think of it as being a lot more cookie cutter and maybe brand oriented. I guess a good starting point to give folks an idea of what we're talking about here is, and what really comes to mind for me is the very first Nitro, which they did from the Mall of America in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which certainly not a venue you would think of as the most logical choice to host a wrestling show. Justin, did you see this? Were you watching live? Did you watch this first Nitro as it happened? Or was that something you heard about and watched later? What are your memories from that event?
Yeah, I definitely watched it live, and I remember it. I mean, I remember it so vividly because it was Labor Day weekend, and every year my parents had a big Labor Day party. That was like their one big thing a year. And it was always usually the Sunday of Labor Day weekend, which was great because everyone had Monday off. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it was rain or some reason, it was on Monday that year. And I remember like the party ended kind of early because people were going home and because they had to work the next day. But it kind of worked out because I wanted to make it upstairs on time and get cleaned up to watch Nitro, which was debuting. I believe, was it 8 or 9 when it kicked off?
I think it was 9, right? I was wondering about that, too.
Actually, it might have been 8.
Yeah, because...
I think it was an hour later.
And it was just an hour when it first started.
Right. So, I'm pretty sure it was 8 to 9 because Raw was 9 to 10 still. And I think Nitro was 8 to 9 because they'd be on ahead of them. Or maybe not. Maybe they were head to head. I don't remember now. I just remember Thunder in Paradise was before it. Yeah, you know, it must have been 9 to 10. I think they were head to head because then Raw moved up to get away from them like the year later.
Yeah.
Right. I was going to say it would depend on when Raw was broadcast at that time, too, because I was thinking that Raw made a jump at some point, and originally it started earlier. But in any case, the idea was to go head-to-head with Monday Night Raw. So, I mean, it would make sense if they overlapped, even with Nitro just being the hour that it was at the time.
It wasn't, you know, I think they started a little earlier or something. One of them, I know Raw would eventually go to like 8:57 to get the 3 minute jump, but, and then Nitro had the overrun to go past it. There was a lot of shenanigans back and forth, but I definitely remember getting it together and then getting cleaned up and settling in and watching that Nitro and just being, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but just being shocked at what was to come. And I'm curious what you guys thought of the mall set up. I've read recently that it's kind of a vanity thing that they did, like, just so Hogan could promote the Pasta Mania restaurant, like, that he literally convinced them to do it there so he could promote the restaurant. I don't know if that's true or not, but
I've never heard that one. It wouldn't shock me. It's one of those deals that it's interesting because you look at it and you go, well, that's certainly it's visually arresting. When you turn on a wrestling program, you see they're in a fucking mall and there's, you know, people on escalators in the background and you got like a Foot Locker and a fucking K Jewelers, you know, just kind of.
I think we ran through all the stores when we did the live watch a couple of years ago. Right? I think we were pulling out the stores that were there. They were really bizarre, some of them.
Yeah. You know, especially back then. So, but from what I understand, it was, and it sounds sort of counterintuitive, but it was more of a cost-saving measure, I want to say, because, you know, you would think going in, it's this kind of special event, but you're saving money at the same time. How does that work? Well, this is during a period where WCW is not that far removed from Eric Bischoff basically calling it quits on the house show circuit because they weren't making any money. Like they were, I want to say that there was a regional promotion that like literally ran a high school gym and outdrew WCW in a, you know, legit arena. Not just as a rumor, but that's something that really and truly happened. I mean, they were canceling shows left and right because the advances were just so pitiful. And this was like, you know, in some of their bigger markets and on, you know, dates that you would think were pretty big business for any wrestling company, like Thanksgiving and or day after Thanksgiving and Christmas Eve apparently were all pretty big shows, especially for WCW and NWA. Dating back many, many years, and they just were not drawing a dime. Eric Bischoff said, that's it. We're bleeding money. We can't do this anymore. And if we're going to be hitting a national stage with this, you know, live television deal, we cannot run an arena and either paper the whole thing or, you know, put all the fans on one side so you just see them on the hard camera and the rest of the place is empty. That's, I mean, that's pretty much going to tank us right out of the gate. So what do? Well, we can't get people to come to us. Let's just go to where the people are. And where are their people? They're in malls.
Especially in 1995.
1995, yes. Exactly. Hence, Mall of America. I don't know how they worked the deal out. I don't know.
And I'm sure, Andy, like, it was obviously big for you being in the Midwest. But, I mean, the legend of the Mall of America even reached out here, you know, like that this biggest mall in the country and that it was just, you know, just crazy of how big it was and how many stores they had and all the amenities they had inside the mall. So it was like, it wasn't just a mall, which was cool that they did. It was like instantly recognizable. Oh yeah, the Mall of America. You know, like you knew about it.
Hey, have you guys ever been to the Mall of America?
I have not.
No, I haven't. I was going to ask you the same question.
I went there in like 98 because my uncle and my aunt, they used to move around a lot because they worked for like a department store. And I think like in the 90s, they used to move around a lot because they'd kind of start up like a cluster of stores and then they move on to the next, district or whatever, or state, and do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so 98, around the time when I graduated eighth grade, I went with my grandparents out and visited them, and I think they lived in maybe like Bloomington, so it was kind of near where the mall was. And we took a trip to the mall, and I hated riding roller coasters, but my little cousin wanted to go on one because the mall's like a huge like square, and in the middle they had something called like Snoopy Land, and there's a roller coaster that kind of goes around the middle. Well, I had bought I think a couple CDs and stuck them in my pocket, and when we on the roller coaster, like the bar came down, and the bar that went across my waist, it didn't actually lock.
Oh shit!
I think God, the CDs and shit in my pocket. It was kind of like bumping up my gut a little bit or something. So I was like, I swear to God, I was holding on for my life, holding on to this bar because it wasn't a fast roller coaster. Like it didn't spin around in a circle, but it actually literally went almost like sideways, and I was on the side where I'm leaning, and I'm like, I could fall out of this, and then. Right at the end of the roller coaster where it starts to like slow down and like plateau, then that's when the bar locked. A shit where I was like,
this is like your worst nightmare as somebody who doesn't like roller coasters in the first place. Fucking bar comes down and doesn't lock.
That is scary. Like, did you not say anything? You just sat there and let it happen, or is it too quick? Did it happen?
Well, because I didn't know that it didn't lock right away because my cousins kind of had that clink.
Right, right.
Kind of locked. And then it started going, and I'm like, oh, fuck. I wish it had been one of those roller coasters, you know, where it took your picture at the end, you know, like, because I have, like, the most terrified face.
Well, at least you didn't lose the CDs. That could have happened, too. It could have flown out.
Yes, yeah. You could have lost your CDs, and you. That's a hell of a memory. You've not only been to the Mall of America, but almost died in the Mall of America.
Yeah.
Shit.
I wonder if another reason for them going there, too, was just wanting to stand out from what WWF was offering at the time. Like, Raw, this was right in the thick of the four-week or three-week, whatever it was at this point, taping schedule in the same as Aseptic Arena with the same format that they've had pretty much since, I think, around late 94. Like Scott and I are reviewing the Every Raw right now for our ebooks, and we're into June of 94, and there's a shift in the presentation right after WrestleMania 10 where they kind of settle into this format of big match opens a show and then squash, squash, squash with all the storylines in between. And they're kind of taping three or four at a time. And it feels like this right now, mid-94, is where they start this format that would eventually settle in throughout 95 and 96 of, okay, you know, 1 week live, three tapes, have one big match open the show, then kind of the squash and storyline stuff. So, like, by, you know, fall of 95, we're about a year into that very just kind of status quo feel that Raw had going on. And so I wonder part of it, too, is that Bischoff just wanted to be different. Like, okay, you're tuning in to Monday Night Wrestling, and holy shit, they're in a mall. You know, they're not just in some stale arena with canned cheering with everyone sitting while we're hearing them yelling. And, you know, like, it felt fresh, like, in addition to having all matches, too, and no squashes.
And when you think about it, I mean, they could have gone to some place like Greensboro, Greenville, or Charlotte, or something like one of their major kind of bread and butter type markets. And even if they did have to comp a bunch of people, you know, you could have gotten asses in the seat, in the seats, and it wouldn't have looked appreciably worse than the, you know, the arenas and the crowds that the WWF was drawing at the time. But, you know, I think when you have the opportunity to save money, which was something that Eric Bischoff, surprisingly enough, was hired to do, at least at first, and still stand out from your competition and make your product look different and special, you might as well go for it. And credit to, and I'm not saying that's entirely his brainchild, entirely Eric Bischoff's idea, but I do think he deserves a lot of credit for seeing things that way, because, you know, he wasn't a wrestling guy. I mean, he was in a sense where he came from the AWA, but he certainly had a lot of different and varied business interests outside of wrestling. And, he brought that business savvy and just that marketing savvy that you don't see from wrestling guys. You can't see Bill Watts doing something like this. I mean, it's just no fucking way. And all in all, it's a pretty good show. I mean, they have that hot opener, of course. It's not 1992 Pillman and Liger, but it's still Pillman and Liger. So something to be said for that. And, you know, some hot acts kind of in the middle, and you close with the great surprise of Lex Luger's debut, and that really did take people by storm, and is certainly an element of helping to put early WCW Nitros on the map. But it all just sort of was a perfect storm and came together quite nicely, I thought. With that said, I mentioned that the motivation for doing this was to save money, and if that was not the prime objective, certainly there was an element to that. When you talk about saving money in WCW and doing things a little bit differently, what immediately comes to mind are the Disney MGM studio tapings that are somewhat infamous, starting in, I guess it was 1993, they started taping shows at MGM Studios in Disney World, not to be confused with Disneyland, in Orlando, and they would just tape a steady stream of content. So here again, if you're not running a whole lot of house shows, you're not doing a ton of live events and touring, how do you produce content? You just churn out these matches in this
marathons.
Studio. Say again.
Yeah, they're just marathon recordings, and like they didn't care. They didn't care if they spoiled stuff or whatever. Like they would cross pay per views, cross clashes, you know, like whatever. Just you'd have guys just coming out with or without titles that may not have had them at that point. So it was just, you know, one long studio taping with the applause and boo sign and everything else. And I mean, one of the cool parts was the ring on the rotating, you know, how it was up on that platform that circled around as the guys made their entrance. Like, that was kind of neat, at least.
Mm-hmm. And you had pretty consistent lighting and just a pretty uniform package that they were presenting in that setting, as different and kind of as, again, out of the box as it was. So you couldn't necessarily tell as a fan that this was taped 2 months prior as you're watching it on television, assuming they didn't, it didn't contradict in anything that had already happened, which did occur from time to time. They had some continuity issues, doing things that way. And it's one of those deals that it just seems like the antithesis of, what has always been done in pro wrestling. Again, you're cramming people in, you're papering your crowds, you've got the signs cueing people who to cheer and to boo, and it's just like, that's not professional wrestling, but it feels somewhat ahead of its time. Not that this is something we really see today, but just trying to do things different, and trying to work with the resources and the assets that you have. I don't think this, in that early stretch, there aren't really any standout shows. You think more of the bungles, things like filming Sid with the world championship, even though his match with Vader, which was supposed to be the plan for Starrcade 93, never happened because Sid got fired, having to scrap a lot of that material. This also inadvertently kind of led to the breakup of the Hollywood Blondes, since they lost the tag titles to, I guess it was Anderson and Roma.
Right.
And then Pillman got legitimately injured before that match could take place, and they had to sub in Steve Regal at like one of the clashes, and it was just like stuff like that that they, you know, could not be anticipated because these are not professional actors. These are not even professional athletes necessarily. These are wrestlers, and wrestlers aren't always the most dependable people in the world. Plus, shit happens. People get hurt, you know. Just
and they didn't seem to give a shit when stuff went wrong either. It was like whatever. Like I don't know if because they just assumed like at that point they didn't have a huge fan base or that they were just kind of working out the kinks or that the fans didn't really care about little things like that. But they didn't seem to give a shit enough to like fix stuff or do it. You know, they just whatever, let's go with it and then move on.
Yeah, and this talk about you know how it really ruffled some feathers. This supposedly really pissed off the NWA, which again you look back on now you're like, come on, I mean, who cares? I mean, that's me, and maybe I sound like I don't know what I sound like when I hear about that and I'm like, that is such carny bullshit, you know?
Right.
Look at Lucha Underground today, which is more like a TV show.
Yeah, I think just at the time people were so hesitant to change. You know, the NWA name was still pretty respected. It had dipped quite a bit since they split with WCW, but it was still like the name itself still lent some credence to importance in wrestling. You know, when they were pissed about something, it kind of seemed like it was an affront to tradition.
The big one seemed to be Rick Rude with the NWA title. He, you know, actually was carrying around at these things well in advance of him actually winning it. In a match, hence the creation of, what was it, the WCW International Heavyweight Championship, which they got the two belts, and it's still the big gold belt, but NWA is pissed, so they can't call it the NWA title. It's just, again, this is wrestling, and this is very WCW.
To circle back with some of the stuff where we're talking about it being mismanaged, I thought of a thing that I sent you in a text. I think it was when we were watching one of these shows, and you were saying, I think you were saying how like Bill Watts was like the vice president, and then that Kip Fry was a president.
Yeah, Kip Allen Fry, yeah, briefly in '92, right? Yeah, before Bill Watts, I guess. Yeah.
I think the thing was that it kind of dawned on me was that whoever is actually booking WCW is actually also the vice president, so they're in charge of not only the booking but the entire company as a whole. And it's, you kind of think of somebody running a company, they would kind of have more of like a business acumen kind of sense, but then it's like you throw like a wrestling promoter in charge of an entire company. So, yeah, it is coming off really carny.
Fucking Ole Anderson. And that was the thing. I mean, WCW's organizational structure was sort of all over the place, it seemed like, where we think of the head booker as being the guy in charge, but I don't know that that was always the case necessarily. I mean, Eric Bischoff is the one that I think of who, he was the executive vice president. Okay, he's got the business acumen, like you said, and he's also involved in the day-to-day promoting of WCW in terms of booking, and they had the booking committee, which certainly he was a big part of. But as far as what kind of titles guys like Ole Anderson and Bill Watts was some kind of vice president, I want to say, but maybe not on the level of Bischoff. So And, you know, you had Dusty Rhodes in the early 90s, who was the booker. But was he having meetings with, like, Turner Suits and people like that? I'm not sure. There's the infamous story about how he walked in on a meeting where I guess they were bringing him back in as booker. And it's a room full of suits, essentially, and they don't really know who he is. He doesn't know any of their names. And he says something to the effect of, "I the rake and you the leaves." And this is not necessarily the type of treatment that that is becoming of somebody in the Turner organization, which he was representing at that right. time, I gather, whether he knew it or not. So it's just stuff like that. You know, as a kid watching, I never would have thought of, but as an adult now and having to work in a professional setting and knowing about things like decorum and, you know, politics, it just blows my mind that kind of stuff went on. But in any case, do you guys have any other recollections of these Disney MGM Nitros? There's kind of probably the last one they did stands out to me, but I'm thinking of that early run and nothing really comes to mind as far as big angles or storylines or anything. Just again, looked kind of cool and different.
So you're talking about because they had the Disney tapings, which was like the syndicated shows. And then the Nitros was that month in July of 96. It was actually outside at MGM Studio.
Right. So that's sort of where I'm headed now.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Just want to make sure I didn't miss out. Yeah, those are interesting too. I think it was the month after Bash at the Beach 96 leading up to Road Wild 96.
Yep.
So they were all outside. It was a really cool setting. I had the big MGM Studios, like big, whatever tin MGM in the back. And, you know, it wasn't a huge crowd, but it was just big enough. You even get to see like the big handicap section of the front, like the very front row, you know, the people sitting there.
I don't know that.
Go back and watch.
Now that you mention it,
it's like all elderly and handicapped people in the front row. It's funny the way it stands out because it's like right front and center. And then there's a big gap before like the stands come in whatever reason it sticks out. But no, there was some definitely memorable moments on that. Like, I mean, that's Hogan's first appearance as part of the NWO was in those Nitros. We had, of course, the infamous lawn dart by Nash to Rey Mysterio. I mean, that's all outside. And that's something that I feel like would have lost a little bit of effect if it wasn't in that scenario. If that was something that just happened like in an arena in the back or something, it wouldn't have been as cool as it was outside of that MGM studio setting. So I actually liked that month of tapings. I wish they did more. You know, if they did it like once a year or something, they never really went back to that setting. I thought it was really unique.
And I want to say they did that. Yeah, that would have been July or August, probably more July 96. I think it's because they were bumping into the Olympics that year. And Turner's production units were sort of tied up, occupied with the Olympics, understandably so.
Yeah, yeah.
And that limited the extent to which they could really tour and do their usual thing. So they kind of camped out in sort of their old haunt, so to speak. And it gave us these, again, just limitations on WCW as a corporate entity sort of was, you know, and that Nitro you had, I agree that it worked better in that setting because you had almost this duality, right, where it's a family-friendly sort of environment where it's a lot of kids, a lot of, you know, old grandmas and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you have this pretty dark storyline taking place with the early days of the NWO where they, you know, fucking kneecap everybody backstage.
Right.
And, I mean, the show just comes to a halt for a good probably 30 minutes while they're dealing with this. And it had that very sort of early work shoot feel where, I mean, obviously it's work, but the fact that they just stopped everything and, you know, treated this like an emergency situation essentially was pretty groundbreaking, I think. I don't know that it necessarily drew huge ratings because it did make it easier to kind of flip channels while there's long stretches of just nothing going on, Sting wandering around. Or
it was pretty compelling, even though you had the option to switch. I feel like you'll maybe more have to switch to it because you're like, whoa, you know, what's going on? And I think there was ever a time where kayfabe-wise something felt like a shoot or realistic. It was those initial weeks of the Outsiders NWO stuff, like where you kind of were like, whoa, you know, what's going on? The way they were presenting everything. I would say from when Hall first came out until right around when Hogan turned, it all very much felt shootish. So I think doing something like that still had that air about it, at least for a few more weeks before everyone kind of pieced together. This was just a big storyline. These guys were on the contract. But for a little while, there was just enough cloudiness there to make you wonder what was going on. And I think that whole panic back in the, you know, out by the trailer, I think added to that feeling quite a bit.
Right, and it was all very tense, and you got guys saying stuff like, oh, there's a third man, or there's a fourth man, whatever, I guess Hogan had already turned, but trying to, like I said, piece together what was going on and what was the story here, and just holding on to every little scrap of information because you're afraid you might miss something. And that's sort of the can't-miss feel of the early days of the Monday Night War. Even though you are flipping channels, you want to be informed and dialed in as much as possible to both products if you're watching them both, which certainly a lot of people were. All right, so we can probably put a pin in the Disney tapings and the Disney MGM studio shows for Nitro, because I do want to talk about some of the more off-the-wall pay-per-views that that WCW sort of experimented with. And, I mean, right from the beginning, it seemed to me anyway that WCW as a promotion ran more pay-per-views early on than the WWF did.
Mm-hmm.
And WWF would eventually catch up and put WCW in the position of, now we've got to come up with 12 shows to fill out a year. But kind of that early advantage, I guess you could say, led to some rather unusual shows. And the first I want to kind of at least pay some lip service to is Beach Blast, which they did for the first time in, oh, what was it, 1992?
Yes.
Yeah, this was one that visually we're going with a beach theme. It's not literally on a beach as far as I know, but you know, you've got the cool stage set up where they've got palm trees and all kinds of props, and there's just mountains of sand on either side of the stage. So they actually, what's the saying, you don't bring sand to the beach? They they've got actual sand piled up, excuse me, in the arena, sort of like a kind of shitty looking blown up Bob Ross esque painting that's like as a backdrop at the entranceway. And of course, all of the announcers are dressed up and, well, dressed down as it were in beach appropriate wear.
Right. We had the big swimsuit competition, I believe, right, with Medusa and Missy Hyatt, where like Jesse's in that cabana being a wicked fucking creep, like in the, you know, hiding in there while they're getting changed and everything. So
yeah,
I mean, that was like,
what was that about?
That was like peak perv Jesse. He was more of a perv in WCW than he was in WWF.
He really was.
But yeah, that's a big perv Ventura moment. I think him and JR call that show. And yeah, it was big. It was like you said, it was, the look was big with everyone wearing the swimsuits and the whatever, the suntan lotion on the nose, and you know, just the overall feeling. I think it was an early, and we had seen this a little bit with Halloween Havoc, but it was an early showing that they were willing to really concept up their pay-per-views to make them stand out based on either time of year or just the overall feeling of the show. Hey, we're on the beach blast, let's really dress up the set like a beach. And WWF really didn't do anything like that for a long time. I feel like the first time they really did anything different was it In Your House when they had the house set up? I mean,
yeah,
I feel like before
really.
That, they never really went outside the box with what their pay-per-views looked like. I guess maybe a little bit like minor things like the gobbledygooker and the egg, you know, and that's not even really Thanksgiving, but even like Jesse wearing the pilgrim hat, like they would do little things like that, but never like a major set, or feel to the show like they did for a Beach Blast or a Halloween Havoc, and even in the early 90s.
Yeah, because their set wasn't really even a set. It was a curtain and then the big logo for like right. years.
Or even like that block video screen starting in 92. So it was definitely a while before they expanded and tried to be a little bit more unique with their sets.
Yeah, I mean, WWF certainly had themed shows with, you know, Survivor Series and Royal Rumble. You always knew with the big draw for those every year what it was going to be, but WCW did that in addition to just kind of these random, you know, like I said, beach themed or Halloween themed just for the hell of it. And I don't know, WWF, the best they came up with as a response or just internally in terms of trying to fill out their pay-per-view calendar was, like you said, In Your House. And
WrestleMania 9 would be the first one where they did kind of outside the box because they played up the Caesar's Palace thing.
Yeah, it's a good call. They really went over the top with it, too. I mean, in a good way. Like, they bought in 100% everyone in the togas and the look. I mean, they really did transform it into the Roman Coliseum. So that's a good one, Andy. Yeah, I mean, they mm-hmm. I would say that was even more so than anything WCW did for a while with how holistically they bought into the setup.
Yeah.
Right, right. It wasn't something that reliably they would do every single year. It was like it would take a reason for them to do it, not just, well, we got a pay-per-view, so what are we going to do? So, yeah, that's interesting. And I don't know, do you guys have any thoughts on why the WWF didn't experiment more with some of their sets and their stages and just formats? Is that, to me, I look at it as just a difference in the WWF wanting to be more of a branded product and presenting that kind of uniformity, even back in the early like Federation days. I think that limited them from experimenting or deviating too much from what you would expect in just a wrestling show. But that's sort of my attitude.
I mean, maybe cost as well. You know, Scott's always made a point, and whether it's true or not, about how, like, they never did, like, a War Games type thing because they don't want to lose floor seats. So, I mean, maybe it's stuff like that. You know, maybe they don't want to lose seating. And I think a lot of the arenas they did seemed more, I'll say standardized, but I feel like WCW ran a lot of these odd places where maybe it lent itself more to a set like that. I don't know. WWF felt very, like you said, very uniform, especially once they got to, like, 87 and, post-WrestleMania 3, where a lot of the standardization across, like, their syndicated shows came into play. But even before that, with 85, if you look at when they start really working more with NBC and Dick Ebersol, you can see them bringing some of those production values into their own programming as well. So I'd say that combined with cost, just that they tried to probably just run as tight and low overhead as they could on the shows. I mean, they just didn't need the big set. They had the entranceway, like Andy said, the big logo, maybe a podium for the interviews, and, like, that was it. You know, like, they didn't go out of the box at all. Everything looked the same. Mm-hmm. And I think they just relied on their overall presentation to win out, whereas maybe WCW felt like they were playing from behind more, maybe, so they had to stand out and be a little bit different.
Could be, yeah. And it's funny how WCW seemed to be into the big ideas, but without necessarily having the production values to back it up.
Right.
Some of this stuff, I mean, you can see that there was thought and effort put into it and certainly money thrown at it, at least I would guess. I can't imagine what it costs to dump however many tons of sand into these arenas for these shows. But without having that same, just the production values that we think of when we think WWF, even from a very, very early time period, not quite there. So I don't know. It's an interesting compare or contrast. We're going to continue this discussion on the outside-the-box WCW pay-per-view concepts and other televised events. Right now, we are going to take a short break. You're going to hear about some of the other great podcasts you can hear on Place to Be Nation, our two feeds. Stick around and we will be back shortly.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And, of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of the Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name. Now it will be known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Welcome back, sports fans, Place to Be Nation loyal listeners. This is WCW Survey Says. Hope you enjoyed your break. I am Tim Capel, joined, as always, by Andy Savage Helene. We have a very special guest with us here tonight, JT Rizzero, Place to Be Nation Godfather, and we are talking WCW Out of the Box. Now, we left off discussing the pair of Beach Blast events from the early 90s. That then led into an event known as Bash at the Beach, starting in 1994, a pretty notable show for being Hulk Hogan's WCW debut, where he defeated Ric Flair. But what stands out to me when I think of those Bash at the Beach pay-per-views was their 1995 edition, which truly took place from the beach. It was in Huntington Beach, California, and drew a crowd that was estimated at about close to 10,000, I want to say, which the WCW announce team promoted as the largest crowd to ever witness a World Championship wrestling event. So, I don't know. The aerial footage was a little suspect. This could draw allusions to our recent inauguration of our current president. But I'm going to leave that one alone, and we'll talk about the event that was. This was, I mean, talk about something that was truly unique and hadn't been done before. I mean, it was a ring set up on the damn beach. There's no real arena. Guys are coming out, like, from behind a tent, I want to say. So it's
yeah, I think it was like a big tent, yeah.
It's just kind of thrown together, and they do have a stage set up with lights, but as we know from other pay-per-views that have taken place over the years, the sun never sets on the West Coast, so the sun didn't go down. We had daylight for the duration of this thing, but it's pretty cool. I mean, it's as far as the match quality, I mean, that's neither here nor there for this thing, but I mean, just to sit down and watch it, it definitely, I mean, it holds my interest.
And they do a nice job tying it in. I mean, they have the Baywatch stuff with the lifeguard match between Savage and Flair, which is a pretty hot feud.
Match, yep.
Yeah, I mean, it would get hotter in 96, but it's hot here in 95 as well. And yeah, they have the lifeguards out there and tie it into Baywatch too and what, you know, going on. And, right, because they promoted the event on Baywatch. They had a bunch of stars, WCW stars, like, on the show, titled Bash at the Beach. So yes. I think they actually filmed some of that here. So it's all, you know, it was good co-promotion. I thought they actually did a nice job with this, even though I'm sure they lost a shitload of money. I mean, they didn't charge anything.
I was about to say, was this one of those shows where it was just, like, show up and be on camera?
Yeah, I don't think they charged anything. I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty positive it was a free show, and
I don't know how they could have. I mean, it's all on a public beach. How are you gonna really?
Right, unless it was like roped off at some point, you know, where you couldn't even get over there. But I guess you could just watch from afar. But
yeah.
What do you think it was like standing in the sand in the hot sun, watching the show for 3 hours, just like,
you know,
baking in the sun? I mean, there was no shade, there was no cover.
No.
Like, you're literally just standing, and there's no seats. So I mean, you're literally just standing in the sun, right? Because I don't think they were sitting in chairs or anything.
No,
I think they were.
They were
standing.
Chairs. Yeah, you're right. I thought that too the first time I saw this, which was really just a couple of years ago. Was, I mean, as the show drags on, and you get those kind of shots of the crowd, people start to look a little bit weary.
Like,
I've been standing a long time. It's hot. I'm sweating. And it was an awfully bright day, I noticed. I mean, that sun was kicking. So you really didn't get any relief in terms of just shade.
I mean, I guess the only positive would be that it was at night on the East Coast. It would have been like, what, 5 o'clock? So at least it wasn't like it wasn't like noon or something where like the sun was at its peak in the sky, you know, like really beating down. So I guess maybe that's a positive. But it was an interesting show because that's where Hogan defeated Vader in the cage to end it. And that's where Vader, I believe, kind of started his face turn, right? Is that when he beats up Flair and Anderson after the match?
Yeah, so he loses, and Flair and Anderson run in and basically berate him for not being able to put Hogan away, and he sort of goes after them, and they bail, and Flair basically face plants from the top of the cage as he's, you know, bolting out of there, and took a pretty nasty bump. I don't know intentionally or not, but
I feel like it was the infamous one where Shivani, yep. Like the nod on air. All right, let's get out of here, Shivani. Oh yeah. Wait, well, look at Flair. Huh? What's going on here? Like they're acting all coy, like the nod on camera. And I just remember that was like a long time joke between me and my buddy Jim. All right, Shivani, we're out of here. Let's get out of here. You know.
And Tony's going, Christine, are we on the air? Are we
right,
still alive?
Are we watching them? What's going on here? But it was. I mean, again, outside the box, it was unique. It stands out for sure. It's memorable, like you said, regardless of the match quality. I remember that. It was one of the first, I think, triangle matches, right? In of the major promotions, they had the Harlem Heat, Nasty Boys, and Blue Bloods. I think it might have been the first one from either WCW or WWF that wasn't actually all three teams. Well, I guess they were tagging, right? So I guess WCW kind of did that before with the Sting, Vader, and Boss thing. So maybe it wasn't the very first.
They hadn't quite worked the kinks out of it yet, but certainly in the early days of that, which you figure that's some ECW influence too, although I'm not sure ECW had even done triple threat or triangle matches really that regularly in 95. But
well, they might have been the first ones that had everyone at once. Like, early WCW ones had the one team was always, or one person was always tagging from the apron. So that was the first few they did. It wasn't, we didn't really get like the triple threat, I think, until, I think ECW kind of started that, where all three would fight at the same time.
Sure, yeah. And, I mean, in all honesty, like I said, these matches, the quality may not be any great shakes, but when you think about, you're seeing a Ric Flair, Randy Savage match. Yeah, it's gimmicked, but it's not like those two ever really did any bad work together. You've got the Hogan Vader big main event, which is a cage match. So you got a cage on the beach as well. It's the chain link style cage, without a roof. And there was an opener of Sting versus Ming. Ming was pretty hot at the time.
Yeah, they had two pretty good matches. They won the Great American Bash and then here. And this kind of continues too, the tradition they started the year before with Bash of the Beach almost being like another signature show on top of. Like, I know you guys have done Starcade where you ran through, because that's their main show. But I think Bash of the Beach is probably a top three for them, along with Super Bowl, where they always seem to focus on making that their big mid-year program. Like, 94 is Hogan Flair. 95, Hogan Vader. Like you said, it was a really big match. 96, of course, is the Hogan turning, you know, at the NWO. 97 was Dennis Rodman. 98 was Karl Malone. You know, so like there was always, Bash of the Beach seems to be the show where they really put a heavy focus on like the main event. Like it was always their big mid-year main event, and then they almost start the
SummerSlam, really.
Right, yeah, in many ways. And Starcade would, you know, it's almost like they booked the first, you know, I don't want to say whole half of the year, but probably like 3 months or so would build to Bash of the Beach, and then they'd, you know, reboot and start to build to Starcade. But I thought, you know, I thought that was a cool through line for them throughout their history. Even 2000, right? Was that the one that's where everything went down with Hogan,
oh
right?
My
where
God. Yeah, the infamous Russo shoot, non-shoot deal, yeah.
Yeah, so, it was always one of their biggest shows of the year for sure.
Yeah, 94 really started the tradition of that being a big deal show. And certainly 95, just their second one, but again, on the beach. And like, you figure all you got to do is show up and you're going to see these big time matches. I mean, that, even if you're a casual fan, everybody knows who Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage are. And you're going to see matches with all those guys. And, I don't know, that just seems like a pretty cool thing, for either a diehard or a casual wrestling fan, whether you heard of WCW or not. It's like, hey, I'm chilling at the beach and, oh, what the hell is going on over here? And it's this big ass wrestling show. And, you know, watching it at home, you've got the great visuals of it, the ocean in the background, and, you know, the sun starts to set but doesn't go down completely. And, you know, it just always makes for a neat aesthetic, I think, when you have these, for any outdoor type or open air type show. Moving right along, we have another themed pay-per-view, kind of, as a matter of fact, the annual event that always took place beginning in 1996, right after Bash at the Beach, and that is Hog Wild, later to be known as Road Wild, from Sturgis, South Dakota, the Black Hills of Sturgis, the motorcycle rally. There's a lot to get into here. Where to start? The impetus for this was not so much trying to save money, was not necessarily trying to differentiate yourself from the competition, but that Eric Bischoff was a motorcycle enthusiast, as was Hollywood Hulk Hogan. And this seemed like a good excuse for them to have a all-expenses-paid trip out to the famous biker rally in Sturgis.
And they would all, of course, they made a big thing about it, you know, where they would all drive out. They'd start wherever and ride their bikes, all part of the pilgrimage to Sturgis for the show. And I get it. Again, I mean, you know, on one hand, it made WCW unique. It gave them a flavor every summer to go out there. And regardless of the reason, you know, it was a cool concept. It was a cool look, and they really catered to that audience. And WCW, you know, WDF, how many shows did they run in South Dakota? I mean, I can't imagine
right,
as many,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And WCW went up there quite a bit. Like, they did shows in Fargo, and they did shows, I think, even in South Dakota outside of this. They ran Idaho. You know, like they did shows that weren't in areas that WWF went. So it was unique for them to go and give a big show to that area. Now, was it another loss leader? I don't think they charged. I'm pretty sure they didn't charge for this either.
That one was infamous for it's just an event that they were
right.
They were running in Sturgis, and whoever happened to be there for the biker rally, that was their attendance, and they did not pay anything to watch the shows. It's just a big group of bikers essentially,
and they were an interesting crowd too, because
say the least,
they would obviously they knew like the name guys, like Hogan was over there and Savage, and they seemed to prefer wrestlers of certain races, especially when you had.
I was about to say it. Unfortunately, it seemed like Harlem Heat in particular had a lot of matches at this event.
I think they fought the Steiners. Was that 96? And it was just a disaster. Like, I mean, the Steiners are portrayed as these big, hulking, basic motorcycle kind of guys, and then you go Harlem Heat out there. Just not a good mix at all. And then that was also the year, a 27-minute clinic between Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko.
Yes.
Wasted. Just wasted on this crowd that hated every fucking minute of it. I mean, the crowd just did not care. Just boring chants. And it was a really, really good match. 27 minutes they gave these guys on pay-per-view. And then you get Hogan Giant ambling through a 15-minute match that they were into. So it's like, it's just you had to know the crowd. Like, you don't run a 27-minute technical clinic out there.
Did you say Chris Benoit?
I did.
Justin, I don't know if you know that joke if you're a few episodes behind, but boy, is it going to ruin it if we just explain the joke?
No, let it go. We don't have to explain anything.
Yeah, but no, it's funny because we talked about that match a little bit on our cruiserweight edition of this program, and it was just like, not that Benoit was typically treated as a cruiserweight in WCW, but it is a cruiserweight style match that he had with Malenko. And I mean, it like goes to a time limit draw and they give him another 5 minutes. It goes to another draw. They give him another 5 minutes. It was ridiculous. And it's just this, they just went balls out in this match in front of like just nobody.
They should have just saved it. It for like the next month or something. And it's funny too, because if you look at the crowds, it's almost like a snapshot of their overall popularity. Mm-hmm. At times, so like 96, they drew 5,000. 97, 6,500. 98, 8,500. I mean, just at their peak. 99, 5,500. And then they're done. You know what I mean? Wow. So like just off a cliff.
Very telling. But
98 was their big, that was the Leno match and everything. So I mean, that was a big one. And they really drew, for it. 96 too, the cover of the tape/poster always makes you laugh how it's Hogan in his, like, good guy outfit on the bike, even though the whole show was built around his heel, his big first title win as a heel.
Right, right. And that was always, it seemed like always a big Hogan show for some reason, where in 96, like you said, he has that kind of snooze fest with the Giant where he lays him out or he's dead for a good 10 minutes.
You just lay there forever as they're throwing trash and spray painting them. And so, I mean, it looks so stupid. And all you do is get hit by the bell. I mean, if you're going to do that, at least do something more severe like that. And then no one comes out and helps him. He's just laying there for all that time. It's just absurd.
And in 97, he regains the title from Luger after that. Mm-hmm. They, hot-shotted it. 98, of course, the big Leno and not Rodman, but the tag with Hogan and Bischoff versus DDP and Leno. They did the Rodman Malone match at Bash at the Beach the month prior. And 99 had another Hogan main event against Nash, retaining
retirement
title and retiring Nash.
Only
for
a
couple months.
And there was another Rodman match too. That's where he fought Savage. I think that's his last match. And isn't that when they go on the Port-a-John? He throws him on the Port-a-John or whatever.
Yes, that's my mom's favorite wrestling match of all time.
The magic of Sturgis.
Going through a bit of a midlife crisis right now, but that's Savage and Dennis Rodman. They're having a wrestling match. And
does anyone go off the cliff as badly as like WCW Savage just completely loses his fastball and like falls apart? Like he was really so good in '97, and then he gets hurt in '98. He has that match with Hogan, where he gets his jaw busted up, and then he hurts his knee, and he's just just not the same throughout the Wolfpack stuff. And then he comes back again, all like ridiculously juiced up with the Gorgeous George and all that crap. But I mean, it just like went overnight on him, but like from 1998 around then.
He really does. And in 1999, Randy Savage is a fascinating case study for me, kind of for all the wrong reasons that you sort of mentioned. But he's somebody that I feel like we've got to delve more into on this show. Because his WCW run, it's just all over the place. Yeah, the thing about Road Wild is, at first, you could kind of make a case for it, but as you got into that 97-98 period where it's sort of like they're leaving money on the table, right? So they're doing this show where they're purposely having no gate and not making money when they arguably could. It's not a case where they're not making money anyway, so who cares? This is during their hot streak where they're really selling out shows and making money hand over fist, and then you do something like this. And don't get me wrong, it's always cool to watch. I have a lot of fondness for these shows. It's just a little bit indefensible from just the business standpoint. With that said, I guess we now can delve into a topic I was really looking forward to heading into this show, which is the Spring Breakout Nitros. Interesting idea here, where starting in 1997, in the month of March, when people are actually on spring break, they started running Nitros from the Club La Vila in Panama City Beach, Florida. Now, I was reading up on the Club La Vila earlier today, and it is billed as the largest nightclub in North America. Were you guys aware of that prior to?
No, I do know Chad Campbell speaks highly of Club La Vila.
Really?
I believe he's been there, yeah. I mean, it looked like a fun time, and I loved that they tied it in with MTV. That they did stuff with, like, the Spring Breakout for them. Like, I mean, that was Spring Breakout was such a huge deal at the time, like, for MTV. I mean, I remember it as being, like, that was, like, one of the biggest weeks of the year. I was, like, watching all the programming from there, Singled Out, and, you know, all those shows that happened from the Spring Break setup. And having WCW tied in
all over the place, right?
Right, just owning it. And, I mean, having WCW tied in with that made them seem pretty hip and with it. Like, even though Hall and Nash were, like, old, you know, it didn't feel that way. Seeing them hobnobbing it with MTV, like Jenny McCarthy and shit. And I thought it was cool. Like, I thought it made them look really neat, like, seeing the NWO out there with doing these MTV things. So, no, I thought it was a cool setting. Like, I think it's one of my favorites. I mean, I thought it was brilliant to tie in. I mean, we have these markers on our calendar, and it's something we've taken on even with, like, the Place to Be podcast, the Place to Be Nation. Like, you know, why not embrace that time of year or the holiday concept when you're a company like this where everything else is so static and so antiseptic? And that's why I never got it with WWE that they don't take, and they're starting to do it now more finally with the network, but why not take more chances to stand out when you have the opportunity? Like, every other show is in a blah arena with the same look. Like, if you have a chance to do something different, do it. So they took advantage. It was spring break. Let's go down. You know, Florida was a hotbed for them anyway. So let's just go to Florida. Let's go to a club like this, and having the pool set up was cool. And I looked back every year, someone went in the water, you know, so that was, you know, that was a nice touch to get into who it was going to be. And there's some memorable moments on those shows. Right down to 99 with the wall. Andy, I think that's when when Hogan,
or is it? Brother, Hogan with the wall. Yeah.
He's like 2 miles away. I mean, you know, this is like ridiculous how far he sees him standing up on that fucking building. Oh my God, that's the wall! You know, it's like Sarah Palin looking into Russia.
Brother.
We're home in Alaska. You know, you can spot like the wall, like just thousands of miles away up on this building.
I don't know what that is. Oh, up there. That's on top of the hotel. That's about 15 stories in the air. Look at that. That's the wall.
Maybe the wall will chokeslam Hogan
that's
from the top
wall,
of the
brother.
Hotel.
Say wall if you want some. Come get some. That's the wall up there, brother.
And, you know, that's a good point. One of the things that's really hovered around a lot of these shows that we haven't really gotten into, but is really worth mentioning is that, especially during the Eric Bischoff era, WCW is trying to shake off the stink of seeming like a regional promotion, of especially seeming like a very Southern Fried type of promotion, where they're all just kind of running in those same markets of like Atlanta and Greensboro and Tupelo, and you know, just that very Southern stretch. Even though they're a national promotion, you don't really see them go outside of that wheelhouse until, I guess, Bischoff comes into play and gets Nitro and has the live show and now can go head to head with the WWF, who have been doing it for years and years. And so I think that these types of shows help to I guess change perceptions a little bit and make people realize that, hey, this is another wrestling promotion on the same level as Vince McMahon's WWF. And now we're not just getting people in the arenas, getting eyes on the product, but the right kind of eyes. You know, mm-hmm. demographics really matter. And that's what these spring breakout nitros were all about, for better or worse. I mean, you talk about, you don't know that, you can't say necessarily these folks are the biggest pro wrestling fans.
It didn't matter. It was a happening, you know, like it was a cool note, no pun intended, place to be. And, but even like, I mean, there was a time in 97, 98 where WCW was more in the general consciousness. Like I remember seeing lots of WCW shirts, and not just NWO, but WCW. I remember, as silly as it seems, like the little quarter, you know, prize things like at supermarkets, like had WCW stickers and stuff. You know, I mean, like that was big. Like that shit never happened in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, I have my buddy Don, who did the dad cast. I was actually listening about this today because I was watching, Bash of the Beach 97. And, you know, he was a big Giant fan. Like he didn't even watch WWF at all. Like he watched WCW because he liked the Giant. Like, you know, when did a WCW guy, if you weren't grandfathered in from, you know, the NWA days as a family, you know, either part of your family history or whatever, who the hell just picked a WCW guy and watched Nitro because of it? You know, it seems so crazy to me that, like, he was a Giant fan. Like, just, like, he wasn't a fan and would like the WCW and like the, like, he only watched Nitro and liked the Giant. Like, that was it. And it was crazy to me how big it got, and stuff like this illustrates it. Like, they were the in thing for a good 2 years.
That's the thing. Even if the product itself and the guys on the show weren't necessarily super hip and appealing to kind of that, you know, young 20-something college age demographic, if you presented it in a way that, you know, the optics, Scott's favorite word, right, looked right, then people would tune in. And just to give an idea of what this Club La Vila setup was like, it's a big open air, not even arena, but kind of outside the club, they would have this giant pool that the ring is literally set up on a platform that is floating, or I guess more properly anchored in this pool with a runway. And surrounding that, you've got fans sort of, I don't even know how to describe it really. It's the club itself sort of wraps around the poolside area, right, where, you know, people are just kind of hanging out.
Yeah, they're up in the balcony. They're up in the boardwalk, you know, so it's just, mm-hmm. it's like Nato 2-0 when they had the keg house, the party. Remember? Everyone's out on the balcony around the pool.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, it reminded me of that.
And, you didn't really have so much fans at ringside because here again, the ring is in a pool, but that wasn't really the point. The point was just being a cool setting where people are and make it clear that people are having a good time. I mean, they might be a bunch of drunk assholes, but who cares? That's what you sign up for, at spring break. So like you said, you got the cross promotional deal going on with MTV. They even had, one of the MTV VJs on the 97 show. I can't remember the guy's name, but, right. He comes out and introduces, Miss Nitro, who, trivia note, was, future sex offender Pam Rogers. She made the news a good probably 10 years after this event for being one of those teachers who was like hot for student, you know, which is gross. But yeah, she was like a middle school teacher and ended up going to prison for.
It all started here at Club La Vila. Just poisoned.
That's where I got started.
John Sencio was the VJ.
There you go.
And eventually would be, of course, Ricky Rachtman, if you remember. Was a big WCW MTV tie-in as well. So the only one that wasn't at Club La Vila, it looks like, was 2000, I believe, was in South Padre Island at the Sheraton Hotel. So
yeah.
It mixed it up a bit. And then 2001, they go, they're still in Panama City, but it's not at Club La Vila. It's at, it says the Boardwalk Beach Resort. And that's, of course, the final Nitro, which I thought was fitting that the last ever WCW program was one of these off-the-wall shows. Like, it wasn't just in a blah arena. You know, it was this unique look. Like, the McMahons were forced to interact with this unique WCW strategy of going to these weird, like, Shane McMahon had to go out to the beach resort to make the deal. You know, it almost like a villain in a bad TV show. You know, it's like, you had to go down to the resort where WCW was at a house.
It's like, you don't want to touch anything.
Right, yeah, just has to, like, bring himself to go to this dump where at least, you know, just kids are partying like crazy. And, of course, you know, we got one last Sting and Flair match. We got a big title change where Booker beat Scott Steiner to be the final champion.
Yep. You get Scott Hudson. Champions. That's how they build it.
Right, all the titles on the line. I guess Tony is all bitter. Hudson's taking shots at everyone. You know, was Madden doing that show, too, or was it just Schiavone and...
I don't remember Mark Madden being there, but I don't.
He might have been gone by that point.
I don't remember much of him.
I just always picture him in the Hawaiian shirt, so I just assume he was there at that point.
It's funny because I always forget that the very last Nitro was a Spring Breakout Nitro. I guess because they weren't actually like in the pool. But yeah, I mean, and I imagine when they booked this venue months in advance, they did so not knowing it would be their very last show ever, but.
So fitting. I think it's perfect. It worked out perfectly. But yeah, 97, 98, 99 were all, at Club La Vila. And like I said, they all featured someone going in the drink. Ray knocked Flair in there in the last time in 99.
Yes. He does like a Hurricane Rana over the guardrail to Flair, putting him in the pool. In 98, we had two guys going in the drink. So it was Ray Traylor, and I think probably his last appearance with WCW, because I don't remember him being around beyond.
Was in WWF by October, right?
Yeah, he was in WWF by October, so he just kind of sat out the rest of his contract. I know he wasn't around beyond March of that
year. That's definitely his last Nitro, at the very least.
Mm-hmm. He puts Scott Steiner into the pool, so
yep.
Recently newly heel minted Scott Steiner with the NWO. I guess Ray Traylor, Bischoff seemed to not believe in de-pushing guys before they were on their way out, so Traylor gets that nice little pop. And then later on, you get the Outsiders, Scott Hall conducting his survey, right? And, out comes the Giant and pitches Hall into the pool. And I want to say Nash followed of his own volition doing a cannonball into the pool.
Yes.
And I say this not even having watched the show recently. It's just, it's that memorable because this is around the time where I got super into watching WCW and Nitro on a weekly basis.
Early 98, such as 92, where the roster was starting to get really bloated. And you see that here, just reading through the results of the show, how many guys are just around, like Bulldog and Neidhart have a match. Ultimate Dragon against Fit Finley, Goldberg against Lodi, you know, Scott Norton and Chris Adams, Raven. Mm-hmm. Raven pins Benoit in Raven's rule match, and that's where they start to tease kind of some of the Jake the Snake and the pass between Paige and Raven. Ernest Miller defeated Yuji Nagata, Steiner, Ray Traylor, Booker and Chavo Guerrero Jr., DDP and Reese, and then Sting and Luger against Hogan and Savage. And this was when they were just starting to tease that the Wolfpack may be coming because Savage and Hogan are having their issues. It's the night after Uncensored when they had the title match. So, you know, stuff starting to spin a bit for the NWO here at this point. A pretty hefty show. Like, a lot of stuff was going on throughout this. I'd say it's probably the busiest spring break episode.
It really is. And we definitely need to talk about Sting's entrance in the main event to that 98 Nitro. He actually rappels down to the ring from a helicopter. It's the type of thing, you know, you think about Owen just, you know, a year and some change later, and it's like, holy shit, they would never do this today.
Right.
I mean, with any, not even like, even if it wasn't the guy, they wouldn't have a stuntman doing, there's just, I mean, setting aside liability issues, there's just no fucking way. And you wonder, like, did they clear this with any Turner people? Because you have the very real possibility of a human being plummeting to his death on a live wrestling program. I mean,
He had been doing it so regularly. Yeah, it's like,
yeah, it's like you almost took it for granted that this is just what he does and it's no big deal. But
I think it shows too. I mean, and if you watch it, all the times he did it, he was always super harnessed in. Not that accidents can't happen. I mean, the big difference is you hear, and I don't want to get too far into this, but with Owen was.
Yeah.
The you know, he just had like the hook on his back, like he didn't have the vest.
Right.
Where Sting always had.
It's not funny. It's really
right.
Sad.
It's ridiculous. It's fucking ridiculous. Because they said they didn't want him taking too long getting out of the contraption, basically. Whereas with Sting, he always had the big vest, and it took him a minute to like get out of the vest and come out. And
oh,
like
yeah.
No one cared. It didn't hurt anything. Mm-hmm. If anything, it added to the drama. But it's cool because Bischoff says, like, there's no rafters for Sting to come down from, basically, like, haha, you know, calls him out for it. And then, so it's a cool payoff when the helicopter comes and he comes rappelling down.
Well, even, like, last night at the Super Bowl, like, Lady Gaga, like, I even thought about, like, Sting and Owen Hart then with her jumping off the top of the
Hell in the Cell.
Yeah, it's leading to some great memes, that's for sure.
Or no, like, I mean, coming off the dome, didn't she literally, like, jump off the top? Was that what it was? And she, like, rappelled all the way down?
Yeah, I mean, she had a lot of faith in the harness that was hoisting her up there. So it's just one of those things that you think about, and it's not like, okay, if this goes wrong, somebody could be seriously hurt. Like, no, if this goes wrong, somebody's going to die. I mean, there's just no way around it. And to think that just a wrestling promotion was doing this sort of thing pretty casually and pretty regularly back in the day before something horrible did happen, it's very striking to look back on, for sure.
Speaking of the spring break and the MTV connection, there's something I remember watching years ago, I think it was 99, and they used to do like an MTV week with like wrestling and stuff. So just have the week of like spring break. Well, I think they actually had like an hour long, maybe it was a half hour. It was a WCW program where I remember they had a ring set up on their little stage on the beach, and they had like a battle royal. And I think the commentators was Kid Rock, Jimmy Hart, and Raven, and then on a stage kind of maybe like adjacent to the stage with the ring, they had Fear Factory was performing. So they were playing heavy metal while this battle royal is going on. Do you guys remember that at all, being on MTV?
Yeah, and I found it here. It was a beach brawl, February 6th, 99, I believe. It was actually recorded January 23rd. Chris Jericho defeats Billy Kidman. Yeah, battle royal. Six-man battle royal, King of the Beach crown. Jericho won. It was actually in Cancun. And yeah, Raven, Jimmy Hart, and Kid Rock were the commentators for the show. It's a good memory, Andy.
Holy
and I think
shit.
They actually did a snow one too. Hang on, I'm looking that up right now. Snow Brawl.
This is where I was, where my fandom started to drift, and I wasn't keeping up with the details so much as just the broader strokes. So that yeah, that's a hell of a find.
So it looks like Snow Brawl might have been right around the same time in February of 99. And this one had Jimmy Hart, Zabisco, and let me see who else.
Larry on MTV.
Yeah, this is a weird one. So, yeah, this says it's February 6th, so it's almost like maybe it was part of that same week, Andy, that you're remembering. Yeah, it aired February 6th, 99. So it was during their extreme sports-themed party weekend.
Oh, okay.
Rob Zombie, Jimmy Hart, and Larry Zabisco were the announcers.
What the fuck?
Stuttering John from Howard Stern was the ring announcer.
Kidding me?
They had a brawl, a battle royal there too. Here are the guys in it. Ready? And you guys tell me who you think won. So this is February 99. Booker T, Billy Kidman, Wrath, Kenny Chaos, Disco Inferno, Brian Adams, and Conan. This is who they rolled out for this big MTV show.
You're shitting me.
It was probably Conan, right? K-Dog?
Yeah.
Who do you think, Tim?
I'm thinking Conan.
Brian Adams won the fucking Snowball Battle Royal. Hey, and apparently, I believe, is this Steve Willie actually did the review of this? No, it might have been a different Steve. But there was a Steve on our old message board. We come up, if you Google this, we're like the old Bigelow 34 Place to Be message board is like the fifth thing that comes up. Someone did a review of this show.
It's a small world.
And I commented on it. I have no memory of this. November of 2011.
So you learned something about yourself here tonight.
Apparently this was in my consciousness at some point. So there you go. Maybe you should link to that in the post there, Tim, that review, brief review of this.
No doubt.
Fucking Snow Andy, that was like, I don't know where you pulled that out from, but there you go. Beach Brawl and Snow Brawl, apparently airing on the same fucking day, I guess.
Very good. Maybe they were gearing up for Brian Adams' repackaging as the Kiss Demon, which didn't actually take off.
So it looks like the winter Snow Brawl was in Big Bear, California, right. And the Beach Brawl was in Cancun.
The network's got to add these to the Hidden Gems
right?
section.
Right? The hell? Well, thankfully, they're in full on Daily Motion on YouTube, so if anyone's curious to go watch them, there they are.
JT, I know there's an event that you want to dive into just a little bit here, and specifically it's for a match that took place. Now, individual matches are a little bit outside of our premise for this show. However, it did take place on a very themed show and played into that theme appropriately enough. I'm talking, of course, about Spring Stampede. This would have been the 1994, 1995 edition with Dustin Rhodes versus...
It was actually uncensored.
Excuse me, uncensored, not Spring Stampede, although I think they did have a match at Spring Stampede.
Yes, it was uncensored 95.
It's funny, I could see that working well for Spring Stampede or uncensored. I don't know what that says about me, but uncensored 1995.
I mean, it was actually the culmination of a great feud that saw... Oh, yeah. Part of it happened at Spring Stampede 94. I mean, this was like a year-long feud between Dustin Rhodes and Colonel Robert Parker that spawned Arn Anderson's heel turn, Terry Funk, like all these guys getting involved, you know, and Dusty
Ming
coming back.
In a suit, which is the coolest thing ever.
Right, and then Dusty coming back at Fall Brawl for the War Games, and, you know, I'll be there, just hug me, you know, like, you know, all that stuff. And Arn Anderson, nothing but a walk behind her, you know, like just all that great promos. And it was... all building to Dustin Rhodes versus Bunkhouse Buck in the King of the Road match.
King of the Road
match.
At the
very, very first ever uncensored and just a, you know, fighting in the back of a flatbed truck. We're going to Subway. No, flatbed truck, like with a chicken coop wiring around it. They have other trucks and a helicopter filming it. And the absurdity is you could tell it was taped across different times. Because some shots is light out, some shots is darker out. Like, you could tell it was filmed in pieces throughout the day, and it's all edited together into this mess. And the best part is, both guys bladed against company policy. They both got fired. I think Bully ended up getting brought back pretty soon after, but Dustin would leave for good and then head to 30F in the summer as Goldust. But it's, you know, the match is stupid and awful, but it's very memorable. Just because two guys fighting on a moving truck, then they got fired for bleeding. And just for the absurdity of the camera angles and the camera shots. And that whole show is a mess. I mean, that's got the, of course, you know, the show that had no rules behind it and then has a DQ on the card with, I believe, Sting and Avalanche. Yes, or was it Sting and Buck? Sting and Avalanche had the DQ.
And the big idea here is all the matches are unsanctioned. As you said, there's supposed to be no rules. This is where you can really point to the ECW influence, I would say.
And it was Savage and Avalanche what ended in a DQ.
Very good.
It's just... Bob actually beat Sting on that show. Like, that's a big win for him.
Oh, yeah, well, they had a nice little run together. Yeah. Had some solid matches. But WCW's commitment to this premise really was not there. Might have been unsanctioned on paper, but that's about it.
Well, even the main event was a mess, too. That's where Flair comes out and drag. During the strap match, and Hogan drags Flair around and somehow wins the match.
Yes,
just a shit show.
He was quite a handsome woman too.
Yes, he was.
kind of had a Jamie Farr from MASH vibe going on a little bit. And they did, gosh, starting in 95, they did Uncensored right up until through 2000. I don't think it's worth getting into the meat and potatoes of these shows on this particular episode, but if you want to see some prime WCW Russell crap, I would suggest you throw on pretty much any Uncensored, because it's hilarious in all the
97
ways.
At least holds up a bit, and that's the one where Sting does his first like big strike when he comes out and cleans house in the NWO. Isn't that like
that
the big
true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a cool moment. I feel like during the peak years it was okay, the 97, 98. 99 has the awful, the MASH actually isn't that bad, but the Hogan Flair with the double turn and the bleeding and the first blood where they're both bleeding. Mm-hmm. And the mess there. And then, yeah.
Well, was that that first spring breakout Nitro in 97, was that the go-home show before Uncensored? Because Piper, when he comes out with his band of merry men who he fires in favor of the Horsemen, he keeps making references to Uncensored, like he's pretending he's giving this shoot promo.
I think it might be the week before.
I think it is, and he keeps saying, "I'm uncensored, I'm uncensored."
Yeah, that was the go home show, because I watched it, and I think Rodman was on there too with the NWO.
You're right, yeah. So that was March 10th. Let me see when Uncensored was. But yeah, you're right, because it was a week before is when he did the tryout with all the guys in that awful never-ending segment. And then they just eradicated all the next week when he just joins the Horsemen instead. Yeah, Uncensored was March 16th. So yeah, this is definitely the go-home.
98, of course, probably remembered for the infamous main event, the Age in the Cage match between Hogan and – or Age in the Cage 2, as it were.
And then, except the next night was the La Vila one with Hogan, like we just talked about, with Hogan.
Yeah, the spring breakout Nitros always took place sort of in and around Uncensored, for better or worse. Now, I mentioned Spring Stampede. They of course, had the unique set design with the stagecoach, and rather than sand, as they would bring in for the Beach Blast shows, they had hay at the sort of top of the rampway. And these would be put to use in various matches that would brawl outside the ring. Probably that first year in 94, the first time they did it, is where they really went all out with the concept.
And 94 had the cool, at least had like the pictures of each match, had like were like the old wanted posters, you know what I mean? Like, so the basic theme was there. Of course, that has the great Cactus and Max Payne against the Nasty Boys, as well as Steamboat Flair, their final match, big match. On pay-per-view.
I guess we're kind of coming down to the wire here, and there's one in particular that we haven't talked about, another pay-per-view. And from that very hot period of 1997, very first show of the year, that being not WCW, but NWO presents Sold Out. It's funny, have either of you guys listened to Tony Schiavone's new podcast?
I have not yet. I am PTBN PWO only.
I understand.
I refuse. No, Schiavone's actually one of the ones I want to listen to, because I'm a big Tony Schiavone fan. I worked hard to try and get him on the Kevin Kelly show throughout the run of that show, and he would not budge. Like, I guess good for him. I hope he's getting paid for this, but he wasn't really doing appearances until, I know he did Jim Ross's show, but I couldn't break him. couldn't get him on KK.
Well, it's funny. He talks about that a little. He says, you know, this guy Justin Rosero wanted me. No, he does get into why he was very divorced from the world of professional wrestling for a while, and that was just a deliberate move on his part. He says that, you know, people think he was really bitter and had a chip on his shoulder and all this shit, but he's like, wasn't that at all? It was just I had to step away for, you know, my own mental health and well-being, and wanted to try something different, hopefully try to reinvent myself and do that outside of the realm of professional wrestling. And now it's sort of like, you know, time heals all wounds, and he's okay to talk about some of this stuff. And he's been, I would say, brutally honest on these just couple of shows he's done so far. And you figure he's a guy that after this many years doesn't really have any axes to grind, has nothing to gain by being dishonest. Drops the F-bomb a lot, which is a little bit jarring when you think of Tony Schiavone as the voice of WCW. Anyway, on his second up, this is all to say, on his second episode, he talked about that first sold out and just sort of, how it came together, sat down and watched the show recently and gave some fresh perspectives on that. And, you know, short of me recapping an episode of this podcast, I would say you can listen to it for yourself. But Justin, I know you've got some memories of this one and some details you wanted to delve into for this inaugural sold out.
Yeah, I remember being pretty excited. It was cool that it was a Saturday night show. It was actually the night before the Super Bowl, too, which was a big one around here between the Pats and the Packers, back before the Patriots were a super annoying dynasty full of douchebag fans. But at the time, it was kind of neat that they were actually in the Super Bowl because there was a ton of excitement locally around here. And so it was a big weekend. You know, like, that was coming. We always had a little Super Bowl gathering, and then the night before was a big sold-out pay-per-view. I don't think I watched it live, but I feel like I got a tape of it, like, pretty soon afterward. And then I remember, I don't say 4 or 5 years ago, I had a brutal stomach bug. I mean, I was just laid up. But it's like, I mean, real bad. And my wife...
Was this during your Rumble trip?
No. Oh, every God. January, Tim, I get the stomach bug.
Hey, look, I feel you. I've had food poisoning more times than I can count. And
it's brutal.
It's, yeah.
And I think this is the one that actually started it all. It was like, I think it was like 2011 or whatever. Because my wife was away for work, so I'm alone. And it's just ugly. And for whatever reason, I turned to this show because it was on Classics on Demand or 24/7, whatever it is, at the time. It was like up that month because it was January and they were showing it. And I remember just like, oh, fuck it. I haven't watched it in a while. And it became like the soundtrack to my lost weekend of illness. Just why I kept like trying to get through it and just like having to keep stopping to go be sick. I love them coming in on the friggin' garbage trucks. And it's in fucking Iowa, you know, like of all places.
Cedar Rapids, yeah, right.
You know, the Five Seasons Center. And they come rolling through the town on the garbage trucks, and it's snowing, and it's just gritty looking. And it was just a really cool idea. Like, it's like, yeah, these guys should have their own pay-per-view. Yeah, they should have it feel different. You know, and they have, like, that voiceover guy just making fun of everyone. And like you said, the NWO contest with all the fat women. And, you know, like, it just stood out as something unique. And I thought it made a lot of sense. Like, it fit the NWO. They were still very anarchist at that point. And it was cool that it was a Saturday night. It made it seem cooler instead of the usual Sunday night spot. And just that opening where they're riding through the town yelling and whooping it up and the snow's coming down. It just felt so gritty and fitting for what was going on. So I just always remember that from both that Super Bowl weekend and then the illness weekend.
You're getting sicker and sicker as you watch this thing.
As the show went on. And then, you know, really ready to put my head in the toilet for Hogan Giant 2, which was just as bad as Hogan Giant 1. The whole show itself, I mean, the matches are not good. I think Eddie and Six is probably the best match, and that's not even great. I mean, that's good, but otherwise, there's nothing else going on that show other than just the unique feel of it.
Yeah, they had a very... in keeping with the biker theme, which I guess had to be an Eric Bischoff special, and we would see that carry over into Aces and Eights, right? And TNA
right.
Later on, it's like, all right, let's give it a rest now. But our good buddy Ray Traylor, who was then Big Bubber in the NWO, I believe he runs over Hugh Morris with his motorcycle to win that match, which is a somewhat unique situation, as our colleague Greg Phillips would say.
You know, it's funny you mentioned, too, like how to the detriment of the crowd. I feel like WCW is another thing they didn't really care about. Like, they were fine just doing these segments that, like, they didn't give a shit. Like you mentioned before with the Mysterio thing in the back. Like, they would sacrifice the live experience for the TV experience in their mind. I mean, even though on TV some of the stuff wasn't so hot. But
yeah,
even like
it was all ratings driven. You're right. Yeah.
And even the Bischoff Tonight Show thing. Remember that awful? He did
live
at the arena. And then the time where they destroyed the set, like that took forever. You know, it's so like all that stuff. He never seemed to give a shit really about the the live experience as much as the TV experience. You know, it's one thing about WWE you can say is they at least care about putting on a show for the, you know, for the live audience, whether it's a dark match after the show or whatever. They try and make it an engaging atmosphere, whereas WCW never really seemed to get me to the point where they cancel the house shows. Like you said, they never seemed to care about the live engagement. They always were more of a TV-based company where they cared about TV ratings. They cared about TV presentation. They cared about, you know, timing things to compete with Raw. Like, that was their focus. Like, they didn't care as much about who was sitting in the crowd and what they thought. I mean, it just didn't seem to give much of a shit about that.
That's true. It was all about those quarter hour numbers that they were really beholden to. You know, you mentioned the NWO Tonight Show takeover and the segments that Bischoff and Hogan would run on live Nitros and Thunders that would eat up so much time. And didn't Bischoff like lower a Harley into the middle of the ring or something again with his motorcycle?
I was at that show.
Were you really?
That was in Providence, and it was the Knights. It was the week, I think it was, oh no, that was, yeah, because that was 98. I think it was the week after DX had invaded the scope. And I remember we were hopeful that they were going to maybe show up in Providence because they were in Worcester, I think, or not, they were close by. It might not have been Worcester, but they weren't far. They weren't far. And actually, no, it wasn't Worcester because WCW was in Worcester the night before for Slamboree. This was the night after Slamboree. And at Slamboree is when Bischoff did the challenge to Vince.
Yeah,
and he didn't show, and then the next night he celebrates. That's when he comes down on the motorcycle, and celebrates his win over Vince. Like, that's how the show opened, and it that's only an hour episode. That was during the playoffs.
Oh,
and I mean, we just wanted to get the fuck out of there and get home to watch Raw so bad. It was really like moribund episode. It was Luger and Bryan Adams was the main event, and that was just paint dry. And then the dark match was a preview of the Bash. It was Hogan and Brett against Piper and Savage, but they were in their street clothes and like half-assing it. It was an awful experience. It wasn't fun at all. We were glad it was 7-8 to get home in time to catch like the majority of Raw.
Yeah, much like the live experience I had of our dark match main event, Ric Flair in a Cosby sweater slapping the figure four on Barry Windham, and that's our match. Oh, I know that's one of your favorites, Andy.
So, Justin, this was part of the origin thing that we usually ask, but I don't think we ask you. Did you ever go to any WCW shows, pay-per-views?
Never a pay-per-view. They were never really around. When they ran that Worcester one, it was before I had started college. But I did go to I think pretty much everyone's probably heard the story, but I went to a house show in later 98. Where Goldberg no-showed due to a storm in Philly, I think. Actually, it would have been the summer, so it wasn't a storm. For some reason, he missed his flight, and they refunded everyone's money, and then I used that money to buy the tickets to the Foley Rock Raw in Worcester. But I think and Nitro, I think those are the only two WCW shows I ever went to, and ever a pay-per-view.
All right. Well, very good. You have been a most excellent guest and contributor here tonight. Before we get out of here, we have some shout-outs to do. Andy, you probably thought I forgot, and I sort of did forget, but I'm trying to save it and bring it back around. We need to do our WCW Fan of the Month, and we have a very special recipient this month. Would you like to do the honors, Andy, of identifying our Fan of the Month for this edition?
Yeah, it was much like Coco Weaver and James Morgan. He had commented and liked on Facebook, and it is – I've seen him comment a lot on the Place to Be Nation, the posts on Facebook. I think I've interacted with him. Jay Hinchy, or however you pronounce his last name. I'm not sure. I think I botched it.
That's right.
Poor Jay Hinchy. He's still on suicide watch after the Falcons Super Bowl.
Oh. Yeah, if he's still having a hard time with that by the time this show goes up, then someone does need to check on him because that's not good. But what is good is that Jay Hinchy gave us a like on our last show. I don't know if that necessarily means he's a fan of the show. I don't necessarily know if that means he listened to the show. But he gave us a like on Facebook, and that's enough to qualify for the WCW Survey Says Fan of the Month Club. So,
well, guys, much like the Hulkster in WCW, I'm a draw, so he'll listen to this one and he'll hear all about it.
Yes, so he'll know for sure that he has won the honors here tonight.
And when I see your numbers going up, that's when I'm going to keep coming back on the show so I can take the credit. And then I'll just disappear when the numbers start going back down and say, those guys can't work without me, brother.
And you can tell us when that's not going to work for you, brother.
I'm going to get all the receipts on your pay stubs from work changed into my name. So, you know, they'll know it's me doing the work.
Shit. Well, of course, we would love to have you back. And since you are the boss, you certainly could come on anytime. I mean, whether we were for it or against it. I mean, we really have no say in this. We're pretty much beholden to you.
I did force you this time. I made you change your talking points, your subjects. So, yeah, I guess I do have that kind of power.
You Svengali'd us big time.
I did.
But we were satisfied to be Svengali'd. All right, gentlemen. Andy, have you got any other contractually obligated shout-outs or shout-outs in general that we need to do here?
Oh, yes.
Get off the air.
I never even mentioned Kurt Kilberg once.
Jeez. I know.
I'm slacking off there.
I know. And I didn't mention Kevin Sullivan's booking even once.
Well, you almost went there because you had mentioned, I think you mentioned watching Road Wild, so you still threw it in there.
Yeah, you notice I held myself back. So, in any case, folks, we are desperately out of time. Once again, be sure to check out Braddock Missing in Action 3 on Movies for Guys Who Like Movies coming up next. Until next month, have a great WCW time. We'll see you then.
We're out of here, Shivani. Right? Come on, let's get out of here. That's fine. There's nothing going on. Let's get
Christine, are we still on the air?
Are we getting this? Are we seeing this right now?
Look
at him. Look at Andy dancing over there. Look at Andy dancing over there.
In his assless chaps. I know.
Thank you.